Let's be dismissed to Sunday school. All the lucky ones get to stay here with me. Look at Matthew 24. Well, that's more or less what I'm going to be talking about. A day. There's going to be a day, and it's going to be a day of rejoicing, and it's going to be a day of glory, and it's going to be a day of vengeance, and it's going to be a day of wrath, and you know, the Bible, all the way through it, is constantly anticipating the end of the world. Look at Matthew 24. If you look at verse, I'm just going to start reading at verse 1. Because Brent will get on me for not reading the context. Anyway, it says, "And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world?" Now, they were very impressed with the temple that Herod had built. God was not nearly as impressed with that temple, even though it was the eighth wonder of the world at the time. Tremendous edifice. They had increased the size of the mountain. They had built huge foundational blocks. Some of them were brought from somewhere there in the Middle East. They brought special sparkling marble and they had built it up. It was a tremendous thing. Herod thought of it as his legacy. And it's an interesting, the whole story is interesting, but the disciples went over there and they were really pointing this out to Jesus. Look at this temple, isn't this just amazing? And Jesus said, not one stone's going to be left on another. It's not that impressive. God's not impressed with your wonders of the world. What God was telling you is there's something else you ought to be paying attention to. And so then they realize, okay, so if all this is going to be knocked down, they're assuming this must be the end of the world. And it wasn't. It was the year 70 when it was all not, actually the year 73 when it was all knocked down and plastered, and the people were moved out, and they made Jerusalem a bunch of heaps and prohibited anybody from living there for several decades. And then in 135, it was destroyed again, and they moved them out and prohibited Jews from living there for about 1900 years or so. It was a long time. But anyway, they got to realizing, okay, then the focus is not on this temple, it's on the end of the world. Did you know that the Bible focuses on the end of the world? Now, I'm not Chicken Little going around saying the sky is falling, the sky is falling, but the sky is going to roll back like a scroll, the Bible says. Something's going to happen to this world. The world was not intended to last billions of years with humans on it. The world has a trajectory, and anybody who knows the law of multiplication, or I should say the law of increasing population, you'll see how it increases. God had to know from the very start that it was going to be a something around the thousands of years, not millions of years, because population increases very regularly, conditioned on what kind of procreation you have. And our type, the human type of procreation, it's a certain period, it's a certain rate. So it comes to a point, it comes to a head. Now, the reason why I started here in Matthew 24 is because last week I ended up with the sign of the end of the end of the world, the sign of his coming was the restoration of Israel. We read many verses that talk about Israel being restored to its land, and there are many more than the ones we read. There is one in Matthew 24. If you'll look at verse 32, Jesus gives us a parable. You might have heard this parable before and its interpretation. I'm going to just briefly show it to you. It says, "Now learn a parable of the fig tree. When his branch is yet tender and putteth forth leaves, you know that summer is nigh. So likewise, when ye shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors." Interesting phrase, right? At the doors. Verse 34, "Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled." The idea is, this is a parable of the fig tree, and it says when you see it shoot forth leaves, it starts getting green, well then you know summer's coming, right? Just like a little while ago, about the first week of February, we looked out and the ash trees had budded. Oh, they had budded. They were all turning green. Ash trees are in San Antonio, they're the first ones that turn green. And so you think, okay, it's spring, winter's over. A week later, or 2 weeks later, we get one of the worst freezes we've had on record at that time. And, you'll see that all those ash trees just went brown. Just, they all, I don't know if the trees are dead, if they can survive that. But, I know other trees, if they bud before they freeze, they die. They don't survive. I hope the ash trees, actually I can't stand ash trees, but, I don't want them all to die on the same day. So anyway. You see the fig tree, if it bursts forth leaves, you say, something's coming. Well, that just makes sense. Something's coming. You can tell the future. You can tell the future. Jesus criticized the Pharisees because he says, you can look at the sky and say, look, it's going to rain today. And he says, and yet you can't tell the signs of the times. He rebuked them. I used to, in Mexico, I'd tell those ladies, I tell them, you guys go to the tianguis, you go to the open air market, and you can pick up an avocado and you can shake it and you can pop it and you can squeeze it and you can say, this is a good one. Now I can't, but some people can. And you can't read the Bible and understand what it's telling you about the final days of the world. One thing is a whole lot more important than the other. And so if you can tell something like it's going to rain today, well, why don't you start looking and see if you can find out whether or not His coming is near. Now, somebody will tell you, oh, these are crazy people talking about the end of the world. It's like we got a sign, you know, on both sides of us walking around saying, judgment's coming, damnation is coming, what have you. And those are the street preachers. They'll show it to you in cartoonish type of ways. They want to show you that we're crazy because we talk about the end of the world. I want you to know everybody is talking about the end of the world now, not just crazy Christians. Everybody, man, the president stands up and talks about climate change and we got one generation to save our world. Well, hello. When Christians say it, you say we're crazy. Now you guys are talking about it. I'm showing you how you can see the day approaching. This is not a mystery. And we're not crazy for saying what's going to happen at the end of the world. Why is this world winding up? It is. It's winding up or winding down. I don't know how it's going to stop abruptly. The world is going to be ended by God. It's not going to fade away in billions of years. It's not going to be engulfed by the sun in billions of years. That's not how we're going to end. The Bible says there is a trajectory and you can see it when it gets close. Now, this is something repeated many times in the Bible. If you have doubts about the Bible, I understand why you would be skeptical about what I'm saying. But if you believe the Bible, then you know what I'm telling you is true. You can see the day is getting close. We talked about Israel's restoration. The Bible several times talks about the land of Israel being like a fig tree. I'm just going to give you some points. Let's see. Let's see if I can find them. Look at Hosea 9:10. Hosea. That comes after Daniel, which comes after Ezekiel. Hosea chapter 9 and verse 10. "I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your fathers as the first ripe in the fig tree at her first time. But they went to Baal Peor, etc., etc." He calls them like a fig tree and like a vine or like a grape harvest. All right, look at some more. Look at Joel 1:7. Joel comes next. It's the next book after the book of Hosea. Look at chapter 1. Now look at verse 7. He hath laid my vine waste and barked my fig tree. Talking about the destruction of the land of Israel. Made it clean bare. Go ahead and look a little farther down at verse 12. The vine is dried up. The fig tree languished. The pomegranate tree, etc. All of these. It's talking about the destruction of the land of Israel. And he says all of these trees have been destroyed that way. Trying to give you a clue what Jesus is talking about when he says there's a parable about the fig tree. Chapter 2, verse 21. Says, fear not, O land, be glad. I must have read that wrong. 22, sorry. Be not afraid, ye beasts of the field, for the pastures of the wilderness do spring, for the tree beareth her fruit, the fig tree and the vine do yield their strength. So there is a point that the fig trees and the vines and these other trees are all destroyed when the land is being punished. And so when you see the fig tree blossom, it's the parable is that the land begins to blossom again. They begin to be restored. And there are many others. But let's just look at Matthew 21, 19. To see another parable similar. Maybe it's a parable. I think it is. Anyway, and he left them and went out of the city. Verse 17, Bethany, unto Bethany, and he lodged there. Now in the morning, as he returned into the city, he hungered. And when he saw a fig tree in the way, he came to it and found nothing thereon but leaves only, and said unto it, let no fruit grow on thee henceforward forever. And presently the fig tree withered away. And when the disciples saw it, they marveled, saying, how soon is the fig tree withered away? I think that is a parable about that generation of Jews being cursed because there was no fruit on them. There's another one. Look at Luke 13 and verse 6. Luke 13 and verse 6. He spake also this parable. A certain man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard, and he came and sought fruit thereon and found none. Then said he unto the dresser of his vineyard, behold, these 3 years I come seeking fruit on this fig tree and find none. Cut it down. Why cumbereth it the ground? And he answering said unto him, Lord, let it alone this year also till I shall dig about it and dung it. And if it bear fruit, well. And if not, then after that thou shalt cut it down. That was in his teaching on his Jerusalem journey. Listen, it's interesting to me to see how many times the fig tree is talked about sort of in a parable way. And I'm not exactly sure whether we can be dogmatic that it's the land of Israel flowering or whether it's the religion of Israel or whether it's these, the certain generation, the people. You can try to aim that. You can try to figure it out. Some people will spend more time speculating about this than I. And you could probably find books that'll talk about it. Just Jesus says there is a parable when the fig tree blossoms. Now, we know Israel was restored to its land. Back in the 1800s, they began to flock back to the land of Israel by the droves with the impulse of Christian evangelical preaching that Israel was going to be restored to their land. And then the Zionist movement came about. And then in 1917, there were some generals in the British Army during World War I that instead of going after the Ottoman Empire where their strategic force was, they decided to go in and take over Palestine. You can read the stories about these generals and the reason why they did it. And Lloyd George and that fellow named Balfour, and they all had this idea that they were going to take away the land of Israel from the Ottoman Empire during this war in order to establish the nation of Israel again. And then it happened in 1948. Even the United Nations agreed to give them that land in 1948. And in 1949, after the war, they established their borders as they were in the pre-67. And then in 1967, they were attacked again and they took over all of of that land west of the Jordan River. It was an amazing thing that God has placed the people of Israel back in their land. If that doesn't wake you up to say the Bible knows what it's talking about. There is an end of the world coming. Now, I started off this series thinking I would finish it in 3 Sundays. I was going to say, take the first Sunday and talk about the anticipation of the day. And you ought to be anticipating the day. I was going to take the second Sunday and talk about how we can see the day approaching. And then I was going to take the third Sunday and tell you what the Bible tells you you ought to be doing if you see the day approaching. Because there's lots of exhortations in the Bible telling you how to live if you can see the day approaching. I've wound up spending now 4 Sundays on it, and I'm not even done with my second point. I'm not even close to being done with my second point. But the point that I'm trying to get to is there is an exhortation in the Bible how you are supposed to live if you can see his day approaching. So the important thing is for you to see it. First of all, the Bible always anticipates this day. Then he says you can tell, it can convince you that it's coming and that it's soon. And if that's true, how are you supposed to live? It ought to change the way you think. Now, if you think just by self-discipline, you're going to stop lying, you're going to stop fornicating, you're going to stop being worldly, you think just by self-discipline, no. You got to be convinced of something. You got to be persuaded in your mind of something. And when you see that Jesus Christ has told you the truth and that the days are coming to pass, it can change, radically change your way of living. And if it were to do that, if it would radically change your way of living, God would bless. He would turn it into something fruitful and bountiful and blessing. God would bless if you could become convinced that the day is near and it changed the way you live. That is the reason why for this whole study. Now, that was Israel's restoration. That was one sign of his coming. If you're there in Matthew 24, I want you to see. Just read on a little bit farther than what I read. Verse 4 says, Jesus answered and said unto them, take heed that no man deceive you. For many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. And you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass. But the end is not yet. All right, there are two things, he says, that are going to happen that you ought to be paying attention to. False prophets and false Christs are going to come and try to deceive people. And then he says, there's going to be wars and rumors of wars. And then he says, the end is not yet. Now, is that a sign that the end is close? No, probably not. He says, the end is not yet. That's not what he's talking about. That's not the end. Wars and rumors of wars. There's always been wars and rumors of wars. There's always been false prophets and false Christ. They've been coming all along. And there are still wars and there are still false prophets. He's just warning Christians during all of this time, pay attention. Don't be fooled by false Christs and false prophets. They're going to come and they're going to say, Christ has come. Come with us. Dress in a white robe and let's stand out on this mountain. He says, don't believe them. So the Jehovah's Witnesses say he came in 1914. But what he said was, when I come, everybody from one end of heaven to the other is going to see me. That's what he said. And so when a Jehovah's Witness tells me he came in 1914 secretly, I can tell them, no, you are false. Look what it says here. You see, that's a good point that you ought to make with them. He did not come in 1914. We would see him if he had. But he is coming. And it is getting close. All right. There's another point to be made there. Keep reading. Verse 7. For nation shall rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. And there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in divers places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Now we're starting to get toward the end. This is more or less what we're talking about. But let me ask you something. Has there been nation against nation and kingdom against kingdom rising up throughout all of history? All of history, always been these kind of wars. And there shall be famines. Have there been famines all through history? Boy, we can just lay up. If you do some reading of history, you want to talk about people suffering. People have been suffering throughout history. Famines and pestilences. You think COVID is hard? COVID is nothing compared to some of the pestilences that have come. Talk about the Black Plague, or talk about the smallpox epidemics that killed 90% of Americans. They say that when the first Spanish explorers went along the eastern seaboard of the United States, back in those days there was no United States, but this was in the 1500s, they were sailing up there, they said that every single cove, every prominent place had houses and cities and lights. They were burning torches all along the seaboard. One generation later, less than 50 years later, when they went back, the English went back there, and it was an abandoned, deserted place. You ought to read the story of Squanto. Squanto is an interesting, fascinating history. Read him. He's the one that helped the pilgrims out because he knew English. Strange thing, this Indian knew English. He had gotten captured. They think by Portuguese or possibly Spaniards, but he had gotten captured as an Indian, and he was taken to Spain or Portugal, and he was there for a long time, and then he escaped and got to England, learned English, and then he decided he wanted to go home. And so he got on a Spanish ship, got back over to the country of Mexico, Veracruz, and walked his way all the way back up to Massachusetts, what is now Massachusetts. And he got to his hometown, and there was nobody there. All his family was dead. The city was gone. It was just ruins. Everything along the whole way was ruins. The entire population of his world had died. And so he was there living with a few survivors in another tribe. And these English people show up, and he speaks English, and he belongs to no tribe. And so he joins them and helps them tremendously. I think of that as providence. You want to study it from some other viewpoint, you can. I see God doing something there, and it's amazing to me. But the story tells you that a pestilence came and killed the entire population of his hometown. And it wasn't just his. They say the Spaniards, when they sailed up the first time up the Mississippi, they've got records of it. You can read about these in a book that I read. It's called 1491. Tremendous book. Tells you how it used to be before the Columbus came. So in 1491, but it says these Spaniards went up the Mississippi River as far as they could go, past St. Louis, way up there. And it says along the both banks, all the way up there, there were villages. But 65 years, 75 years later, there was nobody. The entire population got wiped out. Pestilences? Oh yeah, COVID's nothing, folks. COVID is nothing. I'm not saying not to worry about it. I'm just saying it's not comparable to the kind of pestilences that have been on in history. All right. So when he says there's going to be all these things, these are the beginning of sorrows, we're talking about the church age watching it happen all the way along. And he gets a little bit farther. He says there's going to be earthquakes. You know, when I was a young man, I heard preachers say that earthquakes are getting worse. But then I've actually done some research, and no, earthquakes are not getting worse. There have been earthquakes. Now, they might in the future. I don't know. You know, next week we might have some earthquakes that get worse. I don't know. But there have been some really, really bad earthquakes. They talk about that Krakatoa one, that the thing was felt thousands of miles away. And it sent out so much ash into the atmosphere that there was a severe winter, worst on record, the next year, and several years later, the winter's worse because of the ash in the atmosphere. They said a certain percentage, I don't remember if it was 60, 70% of all the cattle in the United States died that year from the severe winter, froze to death out in the fields. All right. These are not very good signs about how close the Lord is to come back. I don't think that's how you can see. I think the restoration of Israel is a good sign, but earthquakes, not so sure about that until we find some if they start happening now, we might then say, okay, this is different. But We haven't seen the kind of earthquakes that would tell us the sign that he's clear. It's are the famines and pestilences and wars. Now, wars, that might be something, because we've had some of the worst wars within the last 100 years that have ever been imagined. Literally hundreds of millions of people killed. We have weapons of war now that would make all the wars in history seem like small. Although there was one battle mentioned in the Old Testament where it says there was 500,000 people killed. That's some severe battle, folks, when 500,000 people die in hand-to-hand combat. That's pretty bad. Anyway, no, I'm not looking for those kind of signs. I just don't see it there, but I do see some signs. And I think if you can be convinced that there are some serious signs of his close approach, he's coming, and that he's coming soon. Let's go to another one. I want you to look at Revelation chapter 14 and verse 15. This is the one I call the harvest. The end of the world is compared to a harvest. Revelation 14, verse 15. And another angel came out of the temple, crying with a loud voice to him that sat on the cloud, "Thrust in thy sickle and reap, for the time has come for thee to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe." This is the end, when God says, okay, the earth is ripe. The earth is likened to a fruit. And when the fruit is just a bud, you think, no, not ready. And when it gets bigger and thicker, but still green, you think, no, not ready. And it gets bigger and bigger and it's still green, you say, nope, not ready. But when that apple turns red, yeah, then you start thinking, about time. We used to go out to the Dalrosses when they would have their peach harvest, and they'd pay us to go out and help harvest, because you had just a few little days, I guess, or weeks to get all of those peaches harvested. And we'd go, and boy, it was hot, man. It was hot and sticky and sweaty and all that. But boy, you worked hard from sun up to sundown and picked all the peaches you could pick, because you had just a narrow window in which to pick them. And that's what God is saying. The earth is like a fruit. And when it gets ripe, I'm going to pick it. Well, what does this mean then? How is it ripe? Well, there are two ways to see it as ripe. I'm going to deal mainly with the one way, because there's another sign that deals with the other way. Look at Genesis chapter 9. Actually, before we go to Genesis chapter 9, let's go to Genesis chapter 1. Look at verse 28. Let's start with verse 27 so Brent don't get on me. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the fowl of the air and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. What was God's command to Adam and Eve? Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. Now, that word replenish does not mean fill it up again. It means fill it up completely. Just like something is replete with something, it's not filled up again. It's filled up completely from beginning to end. That's the idea. What did God tell them? Be fruitful and multiply and fill up the earth all the way. Get it full. Every corner of it. You want to know what it means when it says the earth is ripe? It means it's full. It's replenished. It's replete with people. Now, I don't know if you've ever driven out in the desert. Doesn't look like there's anybody there. But you go over a little hill and there's hundreds, maybe even thousands of people hawking animals on the side of the road. No, seriously, I'm talking about in Mexico. You go through these deserts and you look out there and you don't really see any lights or roads or anything, but you're driving and then there's people there and they're selling rattlesnakes and they're selling, you know, raccoons and they're selling, you know, ground squirrels, and they're selling things because they want to make a living. Why? Because they live right there. You stop and ask them where they live, right over there. They're, we would drive down these places. We would go because we'd show films or whatever. We'd go out. We'd go out into these places where you'd say, okay, there's nobody there. But every hill you cross, there's a town there. There's a town there. And we'd show the films and then we'd go and look and they'd tell us about another town. Man, we went to this one town. It was out in the middle of nowhere, but there was a train station there. Had 3,000 or 4,000 people living in that town, but it was not connected by any kind of pavement. It was only connected by railroad. It was called Estación Bocas, which means the Bocas is the name of it. It's the train depot Bocas. That was the name of the town. Thousands of people lived in that town. The world has been filled up. Do you know that there are hundreds of cities, what they call mega cities. Mega cities meaning more than 10 million people. Now there's not that many in the new world, but there's an awful lot of them over there in the old world. There's like 50 mega cities in China. There's a bunch of them in India. Cities that you've never heard of that have way more people than San Antonio. The world has filled up. You know that every day on the news, they're talking about how we can't sustain this. They talk about sustainable whatever. If they sell you milk, they'll say raised sustainably. You know what they're saying? They're saying we can't keep living the way we've been living because, we're going to run out of stuff. I remember them telling us that there was not going to be enough petroleum in the ground to finish out this century. That was the last century. Well, they found some more. But everybody knows it's limited. Everybody knows it. There is a limit to how much we can do. There's a limit to how many people can fit. Now, that limit's not shoulder to shoulder, maybe. But you realize how much arable land you have to make one person survive? Folks, the earth is ripe when it's full of people. And what does the Bible say? It's like a harvest. When the earth is ripe, the time is near. Everybody knows the earth is ripe. So God gave you the sign, He gave you the indication, the indicator, and He says, pay attention to this indicator, because when you see this happen, you know it's close. Because God wants you to know it's close. The world is filling up. You know what that means? There's a day coming, and it's a day of glory, but it's a day of wrath, and it's a day of vengeance, and it's a day of culmination of history. It's a day when God's gonna do what He intended to do. And it's getting near. How do we know? Because every time I'm telling you what, just go onto your Google and just type in cities and go to images. I shouldn't say Google. Go to DuckDuckGo or some other place. Forget Google. Go do something and just look up the images and see the pictures of cities you've never heard of. Incredible, incredible. You think New York has a lot of big tall buildings? Try Shanghai. Try Hong Kong. You're talking about 20 million people in one little chunk of land. And this is repeated hundreds of times throughout the world. You go into the middle of Arabia and there are huge cities. Go right in the middle of Mexico, a landlocked city with 20 million people in a valley. Under two volcanoes that are still active, still spit out stuff every so often. Talk about danger, man. What I'm trying to tell you is that the Bible says there is a way to know when the earth is getting close. And the earth is getting close when it gets filled. Look at Genesis chapter 9, just to reiterate or reconfirm what I'm saying here. Verse 1, Genesis 9, 1, and God blessed Noah and his sons and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. God wants the earth full. Why? Because when it gets full, He's going to do something. And it's going to be glorious to Him. That's His plan from the start. He says, fill it up. I want the place full. And then He talks all the way through the Bible. He talks about these prophecies that they're going to come from the farthermost, utmost islands of the sea. and they're going to be bringing him glory. From the utmost islands. Did you know that God wants all the islands full? And just about all of them are. You got people living on all those islands out there. Been doing it for a long time, folks. You know what God is telling you? You can see the day approaching. I wonder how complacent are you going to be if you can see that God has had this planned all along and it's reaching the point of ripeness. It's there. It's close. You say, well, do I have a whole nother generation? I don't know. But you can see the day approaching. You can't tell the day and the hour. You don't know when it's going to happen. Stop telling us what date it's going to happen. Don't listen to the Mayan calendar and don't listen to Y2K and don't listen to camping telling you it's 1988. Too late. You were wrong. But you can see the day approaching and it ought to change the way you think. All right. Let's look at a couple more and I'll end on that one. Look at Joel 3. We've been there before this morning. So get back to Joel. I'm sure you kept your finger on it. It's right after Hosea, right before Amos. Are a few dozen pages before Matthew. Joel chapter 3, and look at verse 13. Put ye in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come get ye down, for the press is full, the fats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Another point of ripeness is wickedness. It's going to be harvested when it gets to a certain point of wickedness. And what does the other sign that it says? It says over there, it says, I didn't get to that point, but it says in Matthew chapter 24, it says, because wickedness shall abound, or iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. You get toward the end and wickedness begins to abound. Look at, let's skip that one. Let's go to, what happened to it? Oh yeah. Look at Genesis 15. I do not have enough time to do a good survey of this part, but it's going to be several months before I get back on it. So I'll give you something to chew on while you're waiting. Genesis 15, look at verse 16. I've got to read the context. I always get to it. Look at verse 13. Genesis 15, 13. And he said unto Abram, know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterwards shall they come out with great substance. And thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace, thou shalt be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. I want to point out to you that this is a very important point, and that is that Abraham was promised a certain part of land. He says, this land that you've been walking on, this land of Canaan, it's yours. I cursed Canaan a long time ago for my own reasons, because of his father, what he did. And he says, so I cursed Canaan, and now Canaan has gone into some serious sin, and I'm going to give you this land, just not yet. Well, Lord, why not now? Abraham says, well, what's wrong? Right now? I want it right now. No, their sin isn't full. You got to wait 400 years for their sin to become full before I judge them. You see how God works? He says, no, I can't give it to you right now because I'm not going to put in the sickle until their wickedness is full. So he makes Abram and all his seed wait, and they have to be slaves, and they got to go over there to Egypt, and they got to wander, and they have all this affliction for 400 years. And why? Because these wicked Amorites aren't wicked enough yet for God to say, I'm putting in the sickle. Now, what that tells you is that when wickedness gets to a certain point, God reaps. God visits. Isn't that what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah? Didn't God come down and say, I've heard that the wickedness is really bad in this city. I've come to check it out. And he sent two angels in there and they said, yep, it's pretty bad. And the next day God rained fire and brimstone from heaven onto those four cities. Boom. You see, because God says, I'm looking at the wickedness. One way to tell about the ripeness of the earth, about the sickle, about God saying the time is coming, it's coming close, is how wicked are people. How much have they deviated from God's design? How much homosexuality will God put up with? How much fornication? How much murder? How much thievery? How much materialism? How much evil in the world? How many little 10-year-old girls have to be raped before God says, I'm done? And if you start thinking about the kind of wickedness that's out there right now, all the human trafficking and the drug trafficking and all the evil, evil that is out there, and all of the promotion of the most wicked things right now by our most highest government officials, you got to say, the harvest has got to be getting close. If you know how God thinks, then you know the day is approaching. I do not have time to keep going on this subject, but I will start it back up in June.